lies, exposes political corruption, and has a clear vision of what America could become. Here's Tom Hartman.
And happy Memorial Day. It's Monday. What is the date today here? The 30th of May. There we go. Mouse over the time thing. Welcome, Tom Hartman here with you, broadcasting live on Memorial Day. Tomorrow will actually be a replay, because tomorrow I'll be in the air. I'll be flying from Portland to Washington, D.C. for the Take Back America conference, where we'll be broadcasting live Wednesday, Thursday, and Friday. But today we are live. Our telephone number, 1-866-889-8894, if you'd like to call in, be part of the program. Anything you want to talk about is fine. I do have, you know, a show set up, and we've got some topics here to discuss, but also you're welcome to drop in and say hello. And if you'd like to drop into our chat room, which is already well populated with people on at least two continents and in three countries, you can go to TomHartman.com and click live chat, and that will get you in there. Somebody suggested I should do a show on draft dodgers laying wreaths at the tomb of the unknown soldier. And I said, who is that draft dodger specifically? And, W is the draft dodger. Well, you know, arguably. He actually, you know, signed up for the military. I'm not sure I would call W a draft dodger. This being George W. Bush Jr. I wouldn't call him a draft dodger so much as I'd call him a deserter. Because if you are absent without leave for less than 30 days, according to the Uniform Code of Military Justice, or at least according to my understanding of it, from what little I know, if you're absent without leave for up to 30 days, then you're AWOL, absent without leave, and there's one set of penalties for that. If you're absent without leave for more than 30 days, then you have deserted. And if you desert during time of war, and Vietnam was considered time of war, then the penalties are pretty draconian. They include life imprisonment and death. And W was AWOL for certainly more than 30 days, several months there, and, you know, no record of it. And his commander's saying, well, yeah, he's AWOL, but, you know, his daddy's an important guy, so, you know, don't get your fingers burned on this one. And as Dan Rather reported correctly, it is absolutely remarkable. You know, once there was a piece in the Daily Cause the other day. Once you start explaining, you've already lost, and it's so true. The cons, what they do is they just attack. They just simply attack. If they don't like what somebody says, you don't explain the answer. See, Dan Rather comes out and he says, "Well, you know, George W. and he's got the testimony. He's got the guy who actually made the phone call to get, you know, to leapfrog George W. 100 and some odd people ahead of everybody else in line so that he could get out of, you know, having to serve in Vietnam, and he could get into the Champaign unit of the Texas Air National Guard." And he interviews him, and he's got the secretary to the guy who's now dead who did the memos, and he interviews her, and he's got all of these folks, and he's got all this information. And then, you know, plus there's this one memo that they're really still, even to this day, not sure of. And the not sure of part they've apologized for. But it really was like second, third, fourth source. But the cons didn't do what it seems so often the Democrats do. The Republicans did not do that. They did not come out and explain. They didn't say, well, you know, the reason why George was put in the Champaign unit was because he really wanted to serve his country. Or he wasn't trying to dodge the draft. Or he was, you know, I mean, they didn't explain. Instead, they attacked. They just simply attacked. Same thing with Joe Wilson. They didn't explain, they attacked. And over and over and over again, you see this same pattern coming out on the Reich. Is that, you know, when they get caught, instead of trying to explain what was going on, they attack. And the Democrats haven't figured out how to do this. And so they get caught, and they're explaining. Well, you know, we did it because of this, that, and the other thing. And no, sorry, you don't explain. You attack. Interesting news today. We're going to have, in the second hour, actually, we're going to be talking about George W. Bush, the war in Iraq, and things that are a little more Memorial Day-centric. Let me first acknowledge it's Memorial Day, acknowledge the people who have joined the service, who have been willing to go off and fight and die for this nation, including my father, who joined the U.S. Army during World War II, and I suppose you could say had the good fortune the war ended. I believe he was in basic training or something. Anyhow, the war ended, and so he ended up going off to Japan, where he was part of the occupation forces in Japan right after the war. And, you know, I want to honor that service and everybody else who has served in our military all the way back to the beginning. It's not easy. It is definitely not easy. And this is the another message that I think really needs to get out there, is that progressives, Democrats, liberals, whatever you want to call this bunch that is collectively called the left, I suppose, by the faux news folks, honor our soldiers and respect the need for national security. And in fact, we were the folks who were fighting against the Republicans to get us into World War II to stop Hitler. You will recall it was the Republicans in Congress, in the House and Senate in the 1930s, who were saying, oh, there's nothing wrong with Adolf Hitler. Rex Stout compiled an entire book of their floor speeches titled The Illustrious Dunderheads, published in the late 1940s. Speeches by Republicans on the floor of the House and Senate in the late 30s and early 40s saying there's no reason to join World War II. There, you know, Adolf Hitler's a fine guy. You know, Time magazine made him man of the year. Just leave him alone. Bloody, bloody, blah. And the Democrats, you know, were, in fact, the Republicans, up until very recently, referred to the Democrats as the war party because they said, well, you know, Vietnam, Kennedy and LBJ, it was the war. World War II, it was Roosevelt, he was a Democrat. World War I, Wilson, he was a Democrat. And I'll give him that on World War I, by the way. I still to this day don't know why we got into it or why Wilson thought it was so important that we get into it. But I don't pretend to be a World War I scholar. Maybe somebody can illuminate me on that. But anyhow, we'll be getting into some more of these things in the second hour of the program. 1963. Well, I'll come back to this in just a minute. Our telephone number, 1-866-889-8894, if you'd like to call. And Rick in Grand Rapids, Michigan on the line. Hey, Rick, what's up?
Happy Memorial Day, Tom.
Well, happy Memorial Day to you too, Rick.
You ought to be working on a holiday.
Well, that's what you do in radio.
Real patriot.
that's just what you do, and it's got nothing to do with being a patriot. It's got to do with being a radio professional, I think. I started out in radio a long time ago when everybody worked on holidays. I mean, it's just what you did. So it's a holiday, so I feel like I should be here. Tomorrow, unfortunately, I won't be here. It won't be a holiday because I'll be on an airplane, but, you know, I try.
Well,
so.
In this short period of time, you've already stimulated me. Just briefly, you know, I kind of agree with you on the World War I business. Do you remember the movie Yankee Doodle Dandy with James Cagney?
Never saw it.
Oh, it's a great movie.
I've seen the clips from it. It's quite famous, but I've never seen it.
Great movie. And what they do is they show James Cagney and another actor looking at a headline that says, German torpedo, you know, destroys Lusitania or whatever,
right.
You know. What they don't tell you is that happened in 1915, and we didn't get into the war until 2 years later. So obviously that had nothing to do with it. But anyway, that would take too long to go into that whole thing.
Yep. Yeah.
I told your screener I wanted to either talk about the Bolton situation or Bush's military service, say, versus Clinton. Which one would you like to tackle?
Well, you can take a quick whack at both if you want. I mean, you know, it's a casual
thing
here.
Well, I guess the thing that bothers me about the whole thing with Bush versus Clinton is, not having been a veteran myself, and I certainly wasn't anxious to go over to Vietnam and kill or be killed, I don't blame anyone for not being willing to necessarily go into the military service. But it is interesting how the cons, as you put it, spin the situation with Bush versus Clinton. You know, they both arguably did dodge the draft. And if I could use another example, you remember John Wayne, of course. Everybody remembers him, right?
Sure. He was a draft dodger, too.
And this was during World War II, and, of course, he said he had a family and a career, as did many people.
Right.
Now, even that would not have bothered me. What bothered me was 30 years later, when there was a very unpopular war, he had the gall to call the young kids then, you know, unpatriotic and draft out. So,
well, it was his persona, you know. I mean, the guy had been an insurance salesman. He became an actor. He was a tough guy actor. That was the role that he was playing. And, you know, and he was probably in with the Republicans.
Sure, he was.
You know, what can you
say?
But
anyway, getting over to the Bolton thing, you know, a lot of people are saying now that the agreement was breached, you know, and even some honest conservatives are saying, no, the agreement had to do with judicial nominations. And, of course, the only thing the Democrats got out of this...
But the agreement you're speaking of, Rick, the agreement not to filibuster?
Yes.
Yeah.
I'm sorry if I didn't explain that. I just assume everyone knows what I'm talking about. I guess I shouldn't. Of course, that had to do with judicial filibusters, which, of course, filibusters were filibusters, and I never really cared for them. But, again, it's interesting how the right wing just spins this to the fact that the Democrats never... Now, Robert Byrd may have pulled a few parliamentary tricks because he's been there so long he knows everyone. But I don't think he ever proposed getting rid of the filibuster altogether. He may have spoken out against it, but he never got rid of it, and neither did any Democrat. They never proposed it. Now, of course, the Republicans are doing this with judicial, but who's to know if they would have gotten their way if that agreement hadn't occurred last week, that they would have extended it to legislation and other things.
Yeah, I absolutely don't trust the Republicans in office right now. It is so clear that they are far more interested in power and power and partisan politics than in what's best for the United States. And that's what concerns me so much. I mean, historically, and Democrats have done this, you know, at time and time again over the last, you know, 200 years as well. But I would say over the last 40 or 50 years anyway that I've been paying attention to this, or 30 years that I've been paying attention to this, it seems that historically both Republicans and Democrats have always been willing to step back and say, well, wait a minute, maybe this isn't the best thing for the nation, and particularly when they get called on it. And the Republicans now, the guys who are in power right now, they're just unwilling to do that. It's all about power. It's about power. Even lying to hold power. It's
right,
all about power.
But I think McCain, even though, you know, he's a little too conservative to suit me.
Well, he's a classic Republican. McCain has come out and said, let's do what's best for the country.
Right.
And that's why he's being attacked by all these other cons, all these other Republicans. That's my point. I mean, McCain is in the mold of Barry Goldwater and Everett Dirksen, which is, you know, he's got Barry Goldwater's seat, I believe, or the other seat from Arizona. You know, the people of Arizona know that. And I guess the rest of America is quickly figuring it out. And he's making these other Republicans look like what they are, you know, fearmongers and power grabbers.
Well, not only that, but the people that would say that he's doing this for politically expedient reasons, out of the other side of their mouth, they say, well, now he'll never win a primary because he's turned his back on the right wing. Well, then if he's doing that, and if he's endangering his base, so to speak, you know, the Christian coalition types, et cetera, then how could it be anything but a profile encourage?
Yeah, exactly. And I don't think, and at the same time, I don't think that the Christian coalition is John McCain's base. And I frankly don't think it's the Republican Party's base.
Oh,
I think it's a fringe group that these guys have brought in to try to expand their base. Their real base is their economic base, which is their corporate buddies. And that's also a big part of John McCain's base. I mean, let's be honest about it. So, anyhow, Rick. Thanks a lot for the call. Good to hear from you. I do appreciate it. It's the Tom Hartman Radio Program, the radio support group of, by, and for We the People. We're live. It's Memorial Day. Our number 1-866-889-8894. We'll be back.
You're listening to the Tom Hartman Program.
They sell us the president the same way. They sell us our clothes and our cars. They sell us everything from youth to religion. Same time they sell us our war. I want to know who the men in the shadows are. I want to hear somebody asking them why. They can be counted on to tell us who our enemies are. But they're never the ones to fight, to die.
No. They just send the soldiers. And welcome back, my friends. Little Jackson Brown there on this beautiful Memorial Day. Welcome back to the Tom Hartman Radio Program. 1-866-889-8894. Our telephone number. Should the government have the power in the United States of America to tell you what religion you cannot teach your children? Should the government have the power to tell you what religion you cannot teach your children? An Indianapolis judge, Cale J. Bradford, Marion Superior Court, After reading a confidential report prepared by the Domestic Relations Counseling Bureau, which pointed out that both parents, Mr. and Mrs. Jones, their real names, Thomas E. Jones and his ex-wife, Tammy, now Bristol, formerly Mr. and Mrs. Jones, both of them were Wiccans. No, Wiccans are not witches, and witches and Wiccans are not devil worshippers. In fact, as they described it, as Wiccans, the boys' parents believe in nature-based deities and engage in worship rituals that include guided meditation that Jones says improved his son's concentration. Wicca, he says, is an understanding that we're all connected and respecting that. He's a computer web designer. Jones says he does not consider himself a witch or practicing anything resembling witchcraft. During the divorce, he told a court official that Wiccans are not devil worshippers, and he does not practice a form of Wicca that involves nudity. He says, I celebrate life as a duality. There's a male and female force to everything. I feel the earth is a living creature. I don't believe in Satan or any creature of infinite evil, he says. And the judge says that he is not allowed to teach this to his son, and neither is his wife, even though they both agree to it, and they are in it, and they both practice it. What is happening in the United States of America? 1-866-889-8894, our telephone number. Lynn in Eureka, California. Hey, Lynn, what's up?
I actually called you a while back asking about the empire in America, and you explained it, and I understood that. But, you know, I've been reading recently a book called The Best Democracy Money Can Buy by Pallast.
Right.
And last night I read the chapter entitled Sell the Lexus, Burn the Olive Tree. And is absolutely frightening. And if you look at what's going on, what they have done in other countries, you can see a blueprint for what's happening here. What they have practiced in other countries has bankrupted them, and they're bringing it here.
Sure.
And I just recommend.
And Thomas Friedman is right at the forefront of this. In fact, he helped invent the whole thing with his book, The Lexus and the Olive Tree.
That's right, yes. Anyway, I recommend to people read that.
Yeah, I do too. Greg Pallas wrote a brilliant book there. And the point of it all is that, yes, there is an empire, but it's not the empire you think it is.
The
conservatives who have been so paranoid all along saying the UN is a one-world government that's going to get us, or that the U.S. government is going to get overly powerful and they're going to get us, and the progressives, liberals, who are concerned that it's the U.S. government that's going to get us, they're all wrong. It's the multinational corporations who have gotten together, and they're getting us.
Absolutely.
And they got us. I mean, it started with Reagan. For 30 years, they've been ripping the guts out of the middle class. Wiping out the average American standard of living, destroying our ability, our buying power. Yeah.
They even go so far as to plan in riots. They have steps that they go through, and they say that at certain step that the people will rise up. And so they plan in to quell
that. Oh, sure. And you saw this in Seattle with the WTO protests.
Exactly. It is really frightening.
Yeah.
Okay.
Yeah, well said, Lynn. Thanks a lot. Good tip. The book he's talking about, The Best Democracy Money Can Buy, by Greg Pallast. The chapter, Burn the Lexus, Sell the Olive Tree. Or was it Sell the Lexus, Burn the Olive Tree? Yeah, that's it. Anyhow, and should parents be able to teach whatever religion they want to their children? Isn't this America? We'll be back.
This is the Tom Hartman Program.
And welcome back, my friends. Tom Hartman here with you, 26 and a half minutes before the hour. 1-866-889-8894. Telephone number, TomHartman.com, the website. When I first heard this story, I thought, okay, this is about a dispute between two parents. That one of them is concerned that the other one is going to teach their child Wiccan or something like that. This kid is actually in a Catholic school, but his father sent him there because it's the same school his father went to. His father's also into Wicca. Wicca, by the way, a religion that is acknowledged by the U.S. Army. Chaplains are trained in it so they can minister to Wiccans in the U.S. Army. Acknowledged by the federal government. But even if a religion isn't acknowledged by the federal government, even if it's not, even if it did involve witchcraft or Satan worship or something, you know, whatever, is it not protected by the First Amendment? I mean, you know, push this all the way to the edge. Assuming that it doesn't involve anything illegal, you know, the sacrifice of virgins or something. Assuming that there's nothing illegal. No torturing animals, no, you know, now that was part of mainstream religion for a long time. Sacrificing animals. But not anymore. Right? So, but it's still there in the books. Should we be purging the? Should the government be involved in this? I don't think so. And this is just such such an obvious issue. I think it just, you know. K.L.J. Bradford, Chief Justice of the Marion Superior Court, over the fierce objections of the parents. Fierce objections. This is from the news report. Issued an order from the bench prohibiting both the father and the mother from exposing their child to, quoting the judge now, non-mainstream religious beliefs and rituals, end quote. Even though both Thomas and Tammy are Wiccans, the mom and the dad. See, when I first heard the story, I thought, okay, you know, one of them is a Wiccan and the other one's a Catholic, and this is about, you know, how the kid gets raised. Turns out, they're both Wiccans. The judge isn't a Wiccan. Non-mainstream religious beliefs and rituals are not allowed for this kid. Not allowed. This is, Mr. Jones says, this was done without either of us requesting it. At the judge's whim, it is upsetting to our son that he cannot celebrate holidays with us, including Yule, which is winter solstice, and Ostara, which is the spring equinox. Yule, of course, has been transmogrified or what morphed into, let's say, into Christmas, and Ostara has been morphed into Easter. Blatantly unconstitutional. So, anyhow, there's that. I just wanted to let you know about this is kind of in the category of PSAs, I suppose. On June 9th and 10th, there's going to be a bunch of folks in Washington, D.C. who are getting together in support of Rush Holt's bill, H.R. 550. VerifiedVoting.org has called it the gold standard of certified voting bills. This event will be organized by Common Cause, Rock the Vote, Vote Trust USA, VerifiedVoting.org, and others. Thursday night reception with Representative Holt, and so on. You can find out more about it by going to VerifiedVoting.org. And just, you know, if you're going to be in Washington, D.C., June 9th and 10th, looks like a good gig. So, wanted to mention that. This falls into the category of, gee, isn't this interesting? Although I suppose it ties back into the Wiccan parents who have been ordered by a court under threat of imprisonment not to expose their child to their religion, to the religion that they raised him in. This is a slight variation on this. This is the FBI, you know, tracking down bad song lyrics back in the 60s. Some of you may be old enough to remember 1963 when the Kingsmen, a band, by the way, from Portland, Oregon. In fact, they had been students at the Milwaukee, Oregon High School. Recorded a song that had been written back in 1950-something. 57, I think it was, originally written. By Richard Berry. 55, he wrote it. On the back of a cocktail napkin. And he thought it was going to be a great song. It didn't catch on. The Kingsmen recorded it. Paul Revere and the Raiders also recorded it, but their version never went anywhere. The Kingsmen recorded it in 1963. And this story by Jim Abbott with Knight Ridder. The vocals that would become so controversial were an afterthought shouted into a single microphone that was hanging from the ceiling to record the entire band. Peterson, the drummer with the band, says of the singing, it was purposely buried. We were an instrumental band, and the only reason we put the singing on it was that we wanted to get this job on a cruise ship. End quote. So this song, which was last month, for a short while, banned by a school district in Benton Harbor, Michigan, although they backed off. I mean, after they were ridiculed on national television by Keith Olbermann, they backed off. I mean, it was the marching band. Marching bands don't sing, so even if the lyrics were obscene, but they weren't, the unofficial version was. But here's the kicker. J. Edgar Hoover spent 30 months investigating this. 30 months. This reminds me of Ed Meese. Remember Ed Meese, the guy who was Reagan's, what was he, attorney general, I believe he was? Ed Meese was so concerned about pornography that he convened, this was during the Reagan administration, he convened a commission to investigate pornography. He decided it was so important that he investigate this, that Ed Meese himself viewed several hundred hours of pornographic video as part of, you know, fulfilling his civic duty. And they concluded that viewing this stuff damages you. And I always wondered what happened to Ed Meese after that. You know, it's like, yes, this stuff, it's terrible, it'll damage you. By the way, I just watched 200 hours of it. Anyhow, the FBI 30-month investigation into Louie Louie, or Louie Louie. We always said Louie Louie when I was a kid. This came out when I was a teenager. And the FBI, by the way, never uncovered any naughty stuff. It's the official conclusion. The lyrics are unintelligible at any speed. So, your tax dollars at work. 1-866-889-8894. Telephone number. Sean in Indianapolis, Indiana on the line. Hey, Sean, what's up?
Hey, Tom, what's going on?
Well, I'm here. Happy Memorial Day.
Boy, if only, happy Memorial Day for you, too. If only J. Edgar Hoover knew about the lyrics that are going through the airwaves now.
Yeah, that's that. I mean, it's incredible.
He would have a fit.
Yeah, I work in I'm broadcasting from a studio here where they've got several radio stations that operate out of the same building, and the one that they play in the restrooms is like the, I don't know, I don't even know what you call the category. But the other day I was listening, as it were, you know, and I thought, you know, this is obscene. I mean, the guys were talking about basically beating up women, and I thought, you know, this is something that frankly offended me. I mean, and I'm, you know, I'm pretty unoffendable. It offended me, and it was on commercial radio. So anyway, I'm not running around saying that the government should be censoring it.
Absolutely not.
Radio stations should be responsible for their communities.
Be censored.
Yeah.
If people don't like it, you know, there's two knobs on the dial.
There you go.
Hey, I called to tell you, I listened to the George Galloway interview. Congratulations on that.
Thank you. We'll be replaying parts of it tomorrow. In fact, we'll replay the whole thing tomorrow.
Okay, great. And he brought up MRSA, and that's the superbug that's going around in the hospitals.
Right, it's multidrug-resistant Staphylococcus aureus, I believe.
Yeah, actually, that's about, I got it about 17 years ago, and I lost a couple of limbs due to these really super-duper bugs.
Whoa.
MRSA came around in the late 80s. And there was a drug called vancomycin to get rid of it.
Right, it's what killed Jim Henson, the Muppets creator.
Yeah, exactly. And then the superbugs got smart to that deal, and they got VRE, vancomycin resistant enterococcus.
Right.
And then they got a drug to combat that. Well, now they've got VRSA, vancomycin resistant Staph aureus.
Right.
So there's all these super bugs, and you can only get them in institutionalized settings like hospitals and nursing homes.
Well, yes and no, Sean. Now, the latest that I've seen in the science press is that they're getting very concerned because as many as 20% of the cases in some communities of MRSE and variations thereof that are popping up in non-institutionalized settings.
Oh, God.
Yeah, and they're thinking that probably what's happening is somebody comes out of a hospital, and say it's a kid, for example, and they're carrying this stuff. And a lot of these staph infections, oddly enough, are carried in the nose.
Yeah.
And they're carried in the nose in a way where they don't produce infection, but they are transmissible. And so there's like this nasal antibiotic that you can, you know, this goop that you put in your nose to kill them off. It takes like a week of doing that. But in any case, these kids, you know, they go back to school or they go to daycare or whatever, and they spread it around, and you know, it hits somebody who's vulnerable to it, and bang, they have the problem that you had. So,
well, and I And let's say for all the listeners out there, if you guys, if anybody out there is going to be having surgery or having surgery, anybody that you know having surgery, make darn good sure that they, you know, that that the nurses and the staff on the unit, post-op, really keep sanitary. Because once you get rid of, they're called nosocomial infections. Once you get a nosocomial infection in your surgical wound, it is really, really hard to get rid of.
Yeah, you got to basically cut out all the tissue. It's
well, yeah, that's what happened to me. I mean, yeah. I lost my hand in 91, and then little by little by little, I lost the rest of the right arm because of it. And we
wow.
just could not get caught up with it.
Yeah.
And some states are better than others because of their environment. You know, I eventually had to go to a dry, clean area like Colorado.
Yeah.
But Indianapolis is wet and it's pretty dirty, so it's really hard for anybody to get rid of those infections there. But
yeah.
But screw mad cow disease and anything else. That's the big epidemic, and we don't hear anybody talking about it.
Yeah, I agree. And as George Galloway pointed out, 10,000 people a year are dying in the UK as a result of it, and that's because they privatized the cleaning of the hospitals. And so now the hospitals in the UK are not as clean as they used to be because the privatized company has as their bottom line, as their first issue, making money. Whereas the state, when they were responsible for cleaning the hospitals, their first issue was making sure the hospital was clean.
Yeah.
And so it's Sean, thanks a lot for the call and for raising the issue. I appreciate it. And George Galloway made an excellent point about that. And it's the Bill Frist problem. I mean, Bill Frist's family fortune. His father's one of the richest men in America, multi-billionaire. And they got their money from privatizing hospitals. And they've paid over $1 billion in fines for ripping off the government, for fraud against the United States government. Bill Frist's family business, over $1 billion in fines. Can you imagine the size, the proportion of the crime that they must have committed? Of course, nobody went to jail. They just paid the fine because, you know, being a Republican means that you're tough on crime unless it's your friends. Marvin near Austin, Texas on the line. Hey, Marvin, what's up?
Not a whole lot. You were talking about the Wiccans. And, oh, incidentally, my condolences to your staff for having to work today, but I'm sure glad they are.
Oh, we're having fun.
Okay. But anyhow, you were talking about the Wiccans, and I was wondering how the judge came to be involved in that in the first place and what the deal was there.
Well, the deal was that the Domestic Relations Counseling Bureau, which I'm curious about this. It doesn't say, and I've read three news reports on this, and none of them get into who the DRCB is. I'm guessing it's, you know, either a private company that reports to the court or a division of the court. But basically, it's probably, you know, set up. Well, I would be speculating. But in any case, the DRCB met with the parents and concluded. Well, in fact, here's a quote from the report. The bureau said in their report to the judge, they said there's a discrepancy between Miss and Mr. Jones' lifestyle and belief system. The belief system adhered to by the parochial school that their son attends, because they have their son in a Catholic school. Ms. Jones and Mr. Jones display little insight into the confusion these divergent belief systems will have upon the boy as he ages. So
apparently the school turned him in?
No, the counseling bureau, the court, you know, I don't know. I just don't know. I mean, the bottom line is not, you know, who turned him in. It's like, you know, should a judge have the power to say, you can't teach your children something?
Yeah, which,
religious,
you know,
something religious.
Makes you wonder how this judge got his job, whether he elected or appointed, and if appointed, who appointed him. But,
yeah, and whether there's going to be blowback on this or not. I mean, it's going to be interesting to follow this thing, to see what, you know, what the outcome of all of this is. This Judge Cale J. Bradford, Chief Judge of the Marion Superior Court.
And whether we're going to hear see more and more of this, or...
Yeah, I don't know.
Somebody going to come down on him like a ton of bricks, or
yeah.
What?
Yeah, it's interesting.
It's kind of like a no-brainer, but apparently there's no brain.
Yeah, apparently. In fact, Sean, our last caller, was calling from Indianapolis. I should have asked him what's the story, because probably it's getting a lot more local coverage there in Indianapolis than it is here nationally. But But this is, you know, I realize that I'm sounding like a Republican in saying this, but it is, I think this is an all-American concern, not a Republican or Democratic concern. And I'm surprised, frankly, that Democrats aren't speaking out about this. You know, do we want judges or anybody else in government telling parents what religion that they have to raise their children in? I don't think so. You know, I just don't think so. I don't think it's right. I don't think it should happen. It's a scary thing for America.
Unless there's a whole lot more to this story than what you've heard, what we've heard. You know, just like I say, on the surface, and I realize what you hear on talk radio is not always all the story. But
yeah.
on the surface, you think, why is this judge? Why is he not removed from the bench?
Well, and it may happen. In fact, the Indiana Civil Liberties Union, the Indiana Department or part of the ACLU, has gotten into the act, and they're apparently suing this judge. So we'll see how it works out. Marvin, thanks a lot for the call. Great to hear from you. I appreciate it. 10 minutes before the hour. Tom Hartman with you.
This is the Democracy Zone with Tom Hartman.
And welcome back, my friends. Tom Hartman here with you, 5 minutes before the hour, 1-866-889-8894. France has said no, and happy Memorial Day, and our salute and thanks to all the veterans of wars and times of peace as well. To anybody who has chosen to serve their nation or who was involuntarily dragged in. You too, Scott? Hang on just a second. Say what?
Well, I volunteered in peacetime and served 2 years in Panama.
Hey, cool. Well,
prior
congratulations. I salute you. What branch of the service were you in?
U.S. Army Military Police.
Oh, my goodness. I got an MP as well, call screener.
I'm protection as well. Thank you.
Okay. Thanks, Scott. Scott Forrester here. Scott is engineering our program today here in Portland, Oregon. He's the guy you speak with. And Scott also does you also do a program on the local community station, KBOO, right? And your own program is about?
It's called Monday on the Environment.
Mm-hmm.
13 years environmental shows, and it's on KBOO.fm. It's a non-commercial listener-supported station.
Yeah, I've done their fundraisers for 3 years now.
Thank you for that.
And, yeah, it's a great station here in Portland. And you've been doing an environmental show for 13 years.
Yes, and that's my focus. The environment flows through everything, whether it's war, economics, business. It's all related to the environment and the planet.
Yeah. So here you are, folks, a couple old radio guys hanging out on a Memorial Day, because that's what radio people do, right? They actually work on holidays. I just real quickly, before we wrap up the hour, I want to toss this in. The French voters rejected the proposed European Union Constitution, and this is a big deal. I was speaking with a friend of mine, Paul Hannum, over in the UK this morning. Paul, in fact, has been a guest on this program, and I'm of the opinion. I'll just speak for myself. That what's happening is that in the, quote, developed countries like France and Germany and the UK and so on, that there's this increasing sentiment that they don't want to have the European equivalent of CAFTA. They don't want to have cheap Romanian labor and Bulgarian labor competing with French labor. They don't want a leveling of the playing field across Europe. And that the corporate powers, you know, the Lexus and the olive tree powers, the flat world powers, the corporate powers very much do want that. And so the French people, 55% to 45%, said no to the EU Constitution. I'm guessing that if they pulled this thing together as a multinational defense force, there'd be no problem. But it's the economic aspects of it that the French people are concerned about. And in my opinion, they should be. It's the Tom Hartman radio program, the place where smart people get their news.
You've been listening to the Tom Hartman Program. Check our website at www.tomhartman.com for archives of this program and more information. calling for a rapid and radical return to the old values that made America great, the values of democracy on which this country was founded. Here's Tom Hartman.
And welcome back. Isn't it amazing? I think one of the big stories of the day, frankly, this Memorial Day weekend, today, Monday, the 30th of May, I believe? Yeah, the 30th of May. I think one of the big stories of the day is that the Teamsters in Los Angeles are not only out on strike against Coca-Cola over pay and benefits, particularly benefits, but that they're calling for a nationwide boycott of Coke products. And yet, if you do a Google search on the news on this, you'll find one small story in the LA Times business section. Whatever happened to the coverage, the widespread coverage in America of labor news? It has vanished. If labor is about something, if we the people are about something, it doesn't make the media. I mean, if some big, you know, multinational corporation, if a big bank, if one of the big phone companies is going to merge, you know, the president of GE comes out and says, it makes headlines. Company stock drops 15 points, you know, it's on the front page. Teamsters boycotting Coke, calling for a nationwide boycott of Coca-Cola products, which would include things like Dasani water and all that other stuff that Coke owns. Teamsters calling for a nationwide boycott of Coke products. I don't see it anyway. It certainly wasn't in the local paper here. The Oregonian, owned by the Newhouse Group, as I recall. And, you know, I had to listen to labor radio news on my own show to find out about it. Go figure. Go figure. So anyhow, there's that. Now you know about it, and you can decide whether you want to participate in that boycott of Coke products and in solidarity with the Teamsters. I know I certainly will. France has said no to the EU Constitution. This is worth just visiting for a little bit of time. And this great piece, Jeff Gelenkirk, in the San Francisco Chronicle, he says he's joining the GOP. He just turned 55. He says, that's it. He says, I turned 55 recently, and having lived more than half my life, I can't afford to worry anymore about the other guy. It's time for me. He says, as a Republican, I can now proudly, indeed defiantly, pledge to never again vote for anyone who raises taxes for any reason. To hell with roads, bridges, schools, police and fire protection, Medicare, Social Security, and regulation of the airwaves. Yeah, be a Republican. He says, President Bush has promised to give me more tax cuts, even though our federal government owes trillions of dollars to its creditors. But that's someone else's problem, not mine. Republicans are about the here and now, and I'm here and now. He says, as a Republican, I can favor exploiting the environment for everything she's got. No need to worry about those quaint notions like posterity and natural legacy. There are plenty of resources left for everyone, and if we don't use them, someone else will. He says, I want a party that doesn't worry about things before we have to. Republicans refuse to get hogtied by theories such as global warming, ozone depletion, fished out oceans, and disappearing wetlands. The real problems, if there are any, aren't forecast to take hold for at least 50 years, so what do I care? I'll be dead. And speaking of Memorial Day, as a Republican, he says, I can swagger and clamor for war in Iraq, Afghanistan, Colombia, wherever. Even though I've never fought in one or even been in the military, I can claim that we're fighting for democracy, ignoring reports of torture at Abu Ghraib, Bagram Air Base in Guantanamo Bay, and a spreading gulag of secret detention centers around the world. Yeah, as a Republican, you can just ignore that stuff. Hey, you know, who cares? So Jeff Gelenkirk has decided he's going to become a Republican. He says, as a Republican, I can favor strict punishment of criminals except those who happen to be my friends or neighbors. Isn't that the very definition of community, looking out for your friends and family? He says, I'll be pro-death penalty and anti-abortion, pro-child but anti-child care, for education but against funding public schools. As a Republican, I'll have a better chance of getting to spout my opinions in the media, which for some reason seems convinced that since Bush was reelected with the smallest electoral margin of any sitting president in history, liberals are passé. He says, as a Republican, I'll say goodbye to old Jesus and hello to new Jesus. Sure, Christ started out as a liberal Jew, and look where that got him. Compassion, love, and diatribes about the rich only encourage the weak and punish the most successful among us. The Jesus that Republicans worship is a muscular, decisive, pro-war crusader hard at work cleansing the world of evildoers, not, God forbid, turning the other cheek, writes Jeff Gillenkirk in the San Francisco Chronicle. He says, let Democrats continue promising the greatest good for the greatest number. Republicans clearly have my number. Number one. He says, as a Republican, I simply won't listen to bad news anymore. Bad news doesn't get me or my family anywhere. If you don't have anything good to say about somebody, don't say anything at all. Unless, of course, it happens to be about a Democrat. Yeah. You, too, can become a Republican. 1-866-889-8894, our telephone number. Logan in New York City on the line. Hey, Logan, what's up?
Hey, what's up? I was wondering, I have two questions. One is, what is the status of the presidential power to declare war?
The president does not have the power to declare war. It's right in the Constitution. Only Congress has the power to declare and make war, period.
Okay.
President never had the power to declare war, doesn't have the power to declare war. I know George Bush Jr. thinks he has the power, but he doesn't.
Okay, so really the Congress is to blame for Iraq more than the president, probably.
Well, it depends on how you define blame, because the executive branch, the president, the Department of Justice, the Department of Defense, and all the neocons, you know, therein, lied to Congress in order to get a resolution from Congress which gave the president the authority to wage war. So,
okay.
So I still place the blame at the feet of the president.
Okay, can I ask you one more question?
Sure.
Capitalism, doesn't it depend on a cheap labor force? And if not, then which example would you point to that it doesn't really do that and is successful?
In its pure form, laissez-faire so-called capitalism, the French for let it be free capitalism, or, you know, unimpeded, unregulated capitalism, in its pure form, will always, I mean, you can look at 1,000 years, you can look at 7,000 years of history of it, will always produce a small, very wealthy and powerful class and a very large, very poor class and no middle class. In order to have a middle class, you have to have unions. In the medieval days, they were called guilds. And, you know, the Masons, for example, the stonecutters started out as one. You have to have something to balance the power of capital in order to have a middle class. And, historically, it was guilds and unions. And the power of government, the power of government to balance the power of capital. There's this dynamic tension between democracy and capitalism. And when that tension works out in a way where there is an actual balance between the power of people, both in the form of unions and government, and the power of capital, then you have essentially the best of both worlds, which is what we had in the United States from the 1950s through the 1980s. And then Reagan came along and said, what? Government? Get in the workplace? In the marketplace? Unions? Can't have that. Got rid of all that stuff. And now we're in we're getting closer to pure capitalism, although we're still a ways from it. And as a result, you're seeing the middle class vanishing.
Okay, so but now, at this time, do you see any, example, Norway or... I don't know. I'm just asking. Do you see any country that fits that model that you think is ideal?
Well, I'm not sure that it's ideal, but it's sure sight better than, you know, it's like better than what we have. It's like Winston Churchill said about democracy. He said, you know, it's a terrible form of government, but it's the best one anybody's come up with so far. If you look at Sweden, if you look at Norway, if you look at a lot of the Scandinavian countries, they have in Sweden, for example, there with the exception of five corporations that are multinational corporations that happen to be headquartered in Sweden. Outside of those five, the CEOs make 30 times, the maximum that a CEO can make is 30 times what their workers make. Workers have strong protections. Workers have, you know, everybody has fully paid health care. You have an excellent system nationwide of hospices for the elderly. There are, you know, free education all the way up through your PhD if you want it.
Wow.
Life is pretty good. And yet, you know, if you want to go into business and make some money, you can still do that. You just have to do it in a way that supports the society. And it's worked out well for them. And what's happening, and this is why I think that the French are, you know, just voted to say no to the European Union Constitution, as many of the Scandinavian countries are very skeptical about this. And in of the nine countries that have voted so far to join the EU, only one of them actually put it up to its people. The other eight of them did it parliamentarily. And I think they did it because they saw what, you know, coming, what the French saw. And because what's happening is with the EU, what they're doing is they're trying to bring all these countries together into one economic unit so that capitalism can become more powerful. And that balancing power of government, the force of government which can balance the power of capital, is weakened because it's the capitalists, for lack of a better word, the multinational corporate powers that are pushing the EU constitution, at least in its current form. I mean, there's a lot of really good reasons for Europe to pull together and form a single bloc. You know, there's a lot of good reasons. But the economic reasons are low on the list, frankly, and it's hurting the well-developed European countries. And the less developed European countries, you know, Poland, which is a big proponent of this, for example, Hungary, the newcomers to the EU, they're loving it because they see, you know, great hope in this, great potential to become like the other countries. What they don't realize is that their fate is going to be just like Mexico's was with NAFTA. You know, they'll be used for a little while as cheap labor, and then once their labor force becomes, you know, gets up to the level of you know, of what the French are coming down to. You know, once that new equilibrium is established,
right,
then the corporations will simply move off someplace else.
Yeah, well, thanks a lot, Tom.
Yeah, thanks a lot for calling, Logan. Good to hear from you. I mean, this is just the, you know, it's the story of how this kind of stuff happens. Mike in Florida on the line. Hey, Mike, thanks for calling 866-889-8894 on the Tom Hartman program.
Hi, Tom. I'd want to talk a little bit about the memo that was in the Sunday Times. But first, if I could, I'd like to offer a quote from John F. Kennedy for today, Memorial Day.
Sure.
Mankind must put an end to war, or war will put an end to mankind.
Yeah, you emailed that to me this morning. I sent it to Louise and said, print that out, and I have no idea what happened to it. I was going to bring that in and make that my quote for the day, and somehow, in all the, you know, rush to get down here and get the show set up, it fell through the cracks. Thanks
no worries.
For, thanks for reminding me of that. Yes. Okay, so you wanted to mention the infamous memo.
This one, it was talking about increasing the bombing raids to get Saddam to react.
Right.
Did you read about that one, or is that something new and I missed it, or old and I've missed?
This is a new story, Mike, that has just come out, and in fact, it's also in my stack of stuff to get here to today.
Okay,
that,
so we'll discuss that. Okay.
Yeah, that turns out there's a new story coming out of the UK that we were trying to get Saddam to react. We just, you know, started massively bombing him as we came up to Yeah, here it is right here. The RAF and U.S. aircraft doubled the rate at which they were dropping bombs in Iraq in 2002 in an attempt to provoke Saddam Hussein into giving the Allies an excuse for war. New evidence has shown. This is from Michael Smith in Times Online. The attacks were intensified from May, 6 months before the United Nations resolution that Tony Blair and Lord Goldsmith, the Attorney General, argued gave the coalition the legal basis for war. By the end of August, the raids had become a full air offensive. So we were already at war, apparently, with Saddam Hussein, with Iraq. Even before Resolution 1441 was passed, that was on November 8th that the UN Security Council passed Resolution 1441. So, you know, it turns out that this whole thing has a long and sordid history, and pretty grim. Mike, thanks a lot for the call from Florida. I appreciate it. Great hearing from you. The second half of 2002, more bombs were dropped than in the whole year of 2001. The second half of 2002. The clear attempt at provocation. I mean, at what point are we going to say, these guys are war criminals, let's do something about it?
Fearlessly exploring the truth of the day, here's Tom Hartman.
And welcome back. Tom Hartman here with you, 1-866-889-8894, our telephone number. TomHartman.com if you want to drop into the live chat room. Happy Memorial Day. Our salute to those who have served in the uniform of our nation. Absolute salute to that, to them, to you. If you are one of them, and drop in and say hi. Mike in Antioch, California on the line. Hey, Mike, welcome to the Tom Hartman program. What's up?
Hi, Tom. I know that you are a person who wants to get the truth out to people, and I'm calling you to talk about David Ray Griffin's books, The New Pearl Harbor.
I've read it.
You've read both of them?
I've only read The New Pearl Harbor.
Okay,
what's his other book?
He lectured on C-SPAN as well. Did
mm-hmm.
you see that?
I did not see it, no.
I don't find the difference between murdering like 2,000 people all in one day and murdering almost 2,000 people from March of 2003 to today. When you bring up the former, people go, oh, my God, my government couldn't do that. But if you compare it with the latter...
Right.
You know, I mean,
we have, as of today, about 750 people in Iraq have died just in the month of May.
Right.
Today being the last day of May.
And I don't want to give the government a pass. I want to go with the original reason we went there, which is to disarm Saddam Hussein. So, in other words, we're still doing that, although we found out Saddam Hussein didn't need to be disarmed. And is that not intentionally allowing people to die, knowing that the reason you went there is no longer true? And
these guys, Mike, these guys knew from the get-go that Saddam Hussein didn't need to be disarmed. I mean, Paul Wolfowitz told an interviewer of Vanity Fair magazine back before we started the war that they sold this thing. They said there are a lot of good reasons to go to the war, but the one that would sell with the American people, the one that it was weapons of mass destruction. He called it a marketing device, as I recall.
But the people who have lost people in 9/11, don't they deserve the kind of hearing that President Clinton had to go through, for example, where he talked about his sex life in front of a grand jury, and it was published on the internet and it was seen on TV?
Yeah, I think
How does Bush get away with not having to testify under oath about that?
Very simply. Very simply, the Republicans control the House and Senate. Period. That's the beginning and end of it. If Richard Nixon had Republican control of the House and Senate, the Watergate impeachment never would have happened. It's just very simple. The Republicans control the House and Senate, and they are willing to tolerate any level of corruption, up to and including corruption that leads to the death of 100,000 human beings, every one of whom values their life just as much as you and I do, Mike.
Right.
And that's the bottom line, and he should be held accountable. Mike, I appreciate the call. Good to hear from you. Scott in San Diego on the line. Hey, Scott, what's up?
Well, good morning, Tom. It's great to hear you live.
Yes, thank you.
Your show is so compelling during the week that frequently I listen to tape delay because I'm a professional writer. I have to focus on my job, and I get all wrapped up in your show. It's really good to be able to call in today.
Oh, great. Yeah, it being a holiday. And tomorrow, actually, is probably the one repeat show that we'll do, you know, this half of the year, but because I'm flying tomorrow. So, but in any case, back to...
Glad I caught you.
Back to your topic.
The War on Terror has been renamed.
Okay.
This is from tomorrow's Post. I picked this up in the Talking Points memo. The Bush administration is doing an internal review, and they're going to rename this thing. It's a broader strategy against violent extremism so they can focus around the world. The major problem they're worried about right now within the administration is a situation called Bleed Out, BLEEDOUT, as hundreds of thousands of the Iraqi-trained jihadists return to Jordan and other countries of origin and begin training other people in what they learned in the insurgency in Baghdad and throughout Iraq.
Mm-hmm. In other words, we have created, in taking down Afghanistan, we closed a terrorist training camp that Osama bin Laden had there, a relatively small one, and we have replaced it with the world's largest terrorist training camp in Iraq.
And far more well-funded.
Yeah. Yeah, and 750 people that we know we have killed so far this month. Every single one of them has mothers, brothers, fathers, sisters, daughters, sons. They have extended family, cousins, nephews, aunts, uncles, and they're all going to be furious. And you wonder, I mean, imagine if the British were occupying the United States and 750 Americans had been killed by the British during an occupation of the United States in the past 30 days. How would we be reacting to that? I mean, that's three times as many people as died in the Oklahoma City bombing. How would we be reacting to that? I have a feeling it wouldn't be very pleasant. Scott, thanks a lot for the call. Good to hear from you. I appreciate it. 29 minutes past the hour.
Democracy to the United States of America. Here's Tom Hartman.
Well, maybe we do want to know. Welcome back. 27 minutes before the hour. Tom Hartman here with you. Broadcasting live on radio stations from California to North Carolina. Here on Memorial Day, beaming down from outer space on the Sirius satellite radio systems, beaming around the planet. Speeding around the planet? No, that's Superman does that. Beaming around the planet on RadioPower.org, WhiteRoseSociety.org, Live 365's American FM, and also on radio cable TV systems in 29 states on CRN Digital. Those high channels there where you get the the funny music. Anyway, welcome back to our program. John Bonifaz and David Swanson are with us. David has been on this program many times with Progressive Democrats of America and davidswanson.com, right, David?
That'll work, or .org.
Or .org, okay. And John is an attorney in out of Boston specializing in constitutional litigation. And, John, you recently sent a memo to John Conyers. Tell us about that.
Yes. The memo basically outlines the case for why Representative Conyers and other members of Congress should now introduce a resolution of inquiry to call for a full investigation to whether or not the president has committed impeachable offenses in connection with the Iraq War. And the basis of this resolution, in my view, focuses primarily on the evidence that has recently come to light in the Downing Street minutes. These are minutes held, taken in a secret meeting in July of 2002 in London, at which Tony Blair and his cabinet heard a report from the senior intelligence officer in Britain based on meetings he had in Washington coming back from those meetings in July of 2002. And in those minutes, it stated that intelligence would be fixed around the policy within the Bush administration with respect to going to war against Iraq, and that they had made their mind up to invade Iraq long before they even went to Congress or to the United Nations with this matter.
Right. One of the reasons I think that this has so flown under the radar of average Americans, aside from the fact that the mainstream media basically has not covered it and had to be bludgeoned into even mentioning it, embarrassed into it, I guess, is that most people don't have in their minds a clear timeline of what happened when. It's, you know, time is this kind of, you know, fungible thing or whatever in people's heads, and you think back and, oh, well, you know, okay, so they were talking about this, but when was that, and what does, and people don't remember the things that the Bush administration was saying about how no decision had been made and that, you know, blah, blah, blah. Can you give us a quick summary of the timeline of what we saw happening and, you know, and superimpose on it the timeline of what was, according to the Downing Street memo, actually happening?
Sure. In October of 2002, the White House went to the United States Congress with a resolution on Iraq, which they purported to argue would authorize an invasion of Iraq. And I, on behalf of others as well, sought to challenge that resolution as being unconstitutional in that it really was delegating from Congress to the president the power to declare war. But that being said, that was the official timeline for the congressional debate on this matter, and following that October resolution being passed in 2002, the White House and Tony Blair then went to the United Nations in November of 2002 to seek an official resolution that would force new inspections into the country to determine whether or not there were weapons of mass destruction. Then, as we know,
all of this, if I may interrupt, all of this timed very nicely with the 2002 congressional elections, the midterm elections, and helped bring a Republican majority back into the Senate and into the House of Representatives. It was a brilliant, brilliant political ploy on the part of Karl Rove and George Bush to time this the way they did.
Absolutely, and it's a crucial point that people who were voting on this in October 2002 were doing so in the wake of an election about to happen. And then in March of 2003, of course, the invasion occurred. Absent any new UN resolution, the White House and Tony Blair withdrew any effort from getting a new resolution, despite claims that rightly were being made around the world that there needed to be, under international law, a UN approval to this aggressive, preemptive strike of another nation. All that occurred in the context of the Bush administration having months before October 2002 planned to invade Iraq, overthrow the regime of Saddam Hussein, and use as a pretext, according to these minutes, the threat of weapons of mass destruction. They would fix that threat around the policy, that they would essentially falsify intelligence to present a threat that did not exist. And as we know now, there were no weapons of mass destruction found. There was no link to Al-Qaeda or September 11th. And this president, we believe, if this evidence is true, should now be held accountable for these illegal and impeachable actions.
John Bonifaz, why is the Downing Street memo any more significant than, for example, the revelations of Paul O'Neill in his book, saying that when he first, you know, former Treasury Secretary Paul O'Neill, that in 2001, when the Bush administration took office, within days of taking office, they were making it clear that they intended to invade Iraq one way or another.
Well, I think the main distinction is that that's a statement being made by somebody who has since left the Bush administration. There will be those who try to argue that he's disgruntled in some way, that he's no longer in the Bush cabinet. Richard Clark has made similar claims. Bob Woodward, in his report, in his book, has made Bush at War, has made similar claims. But these are official minutes. These are minutes of a secret meeting that occurred in London just after the senior intelligence officer from Britain had come back from Washington. And these official minutes lay out very clearly what O'Neill and what Clark and what's been reported in Bob Woodward's book have all said. And I think now we have the evidence that pushes this into the need for an investigation.
So what's different about this is that this is actually firsthand evidence as opposed to secondhand hearsay.
This is government evidence. These are official minutes of a secret government meeting.
This nails it down. Okay, John Bonifaz, the attorney who has proposed to John Conyers, Congressman John Conyers, who's been a regular guest on this program, that he propose a resolution of inquiry for the House of the House of Representatives of the United States to consider the impeachment of George W. Bush for it wouldn't be for war crimes, would it? I mean, what would the term be? What's the shorthand?
Well, under Article 2, Section 4 of the U.S. Constitution, it would be considered a high crime. I mean, the president.
But what's the name of the crime?
The name of the crime is, in part, engaging in a conspiracy to mislead and deceive the United States Congress and the American people.
So lying to Congress and the American people.
Yes, which includes felonies that have been committed under federal criminal law as well.
Okay, good. Now, David Swanson, you swim in more political waters here, I suspect, than John. What is your take on how viable this is? Isn't this kind of like spitting into the wind? I mean, you've got Republicans controlling both the House and the Senate. You've got Republicans controlling the voting machines, and you've got Republicans in large part controlling the national mainstream media.
Well, it's an uphill fight, but what isn't? You know, this is something that that more people around the country and penetrating most areas of the political spectrum are energized about. And, you know, obviously there are majority positions in this country that we can't get through Congress. We can't get a decent minimum wage. We can't get the right to organize it, and so on. They're all uphill fights. But this is something that, you know, we can't stay silent about.
But didn't Ramsey Clark do this 2 years ago? Didn't he come up with, you know, Jimmy Carter's former Secretary of what was Ramsey Clark's position? Was he the Secretary of State, wasn't he?
He was Attorney General, I believe.
Attorney General, yeah, right, okay. And didn't he come up with, didn't he draft articles of impeachment, and didn't a member of Congress introduce those?
I think that's right. John may be able to confirm that.
Well, actually, no member of Congress has introduced, with respect to this president, articles of impeachment, and Ramsey Clark did draft those articles of impeachment. But again, I would emphasize that what's different here is we have official government minutes of a meeting that reveals.
Right. We now have the smoking gun. Ramsey Clark didn't have a smoking gun. He just had enough evidence that he felt that they should open an inquiry. And let's, you know, make sure that our listeners understand, impeachment doesn't mean removal from office. Impeachment is the same thing as an indictment for a crime. You have the impeachment by the House of Representatives, which means that the president has been charged with a crime. And then you have the actual trial in the Senate. And if he's convicted at that trial, then he's removed from office. If he's not convicted from that trial, then, like was the case with Bill Clinton and also with Andrew Johnson, then he's held as impeached but not convicted, or charged but not convicted. It would be the criminal court, normal mainstream criminal court similarity.
I think that's important to remember, and also that a resolution of inquiry is not even impeachment, is not even an indictment. It's a resolution to look into the evidence.
But it does require a majority vote of Congress, does it not, to impeach a president?
It does require a majority vote of Congress, but I think the point here is we have to begin somewhere, and this is the place to begin. This is the first step. This is how the Nixon impeachment proceeding began. It's how the Clinton impeachment proceeding began. It's a call for a full investigation into whether or not these are high crimes.
John Bonifaz is speaking. John, has Congressman Conyers said that he will introduce this resolution?
Well, he has the memo, and we're hopeful that from support of people all over this country calling on him, emailing him, writing letters, that he will do this. But he needs to hear from all of us. He needs to know that this is what the people are demanding.
Well, it's interesting. We're on the air, certainly in Michigan, as well as in other parts of the country. I mean, this is a national issue as well, but Congressman Conyers is from Michigan. The toll-free telephone number for the United States House of Representatives, and you simply call this number and ask for Congressman Conyers, John Conyers' office, and they'll put you through. It's a holiday today. Today is Memorial Day, but odds are they've got voicemail or something. And certainly you can call tomorrow. The toll-free number for Congress is 1-877-SOB, the letter U-S-O-B. 1-877-SOB-U-S-O-B. That gets you to the Capitol switchboard, and then you simply ask for John Conyers' office, and there you go. So,
and, Tom, I would also add that our website, afterdowningstreet.org, which is this coalition of veterans groups, peace groups, and organizations all over this country, afterdowningstreet.org will give people links to how to access their member of Congress as well as Representative Conyers. And the reason why Representative Conyers is our person we really want to urge to do this is he's the ranking member on the Judiciary Committee. He was on the Judiciary Committee, as we know, during the Watergate scandal, and he's the one who can lead the way as he has in the past, and we need to urge him to do so.
Wow, he was on the Judiciary Committee during Watergate?
Yes. And he has already said publicly in a letter to the president and a letter to Don Rumsfeld that he views these matters as very serious and very grave.
Yeah.
And I think that the point is he needs to hear from us that we want to take it to this important level.
Yeah. I the last time John Conyers was on this program, I told him I considered him one of our wise elders, one of the people who really – I didn't realize he'd been in the House that long. That's remarkable. So
yeah,
he was there through Clinton's impeachment as well.
Yes.
Yeah, I agree with that, Tom. And at afterdowningstreet.org, you can click a link to write to John Conyers or to your Congress member. You can also click another link to sign a letter. Congressman Conyers has a letter. He's asked for 100,000 signatures, and then he promises to deliver it personally to the president, asking the president questions about the Downing Street minutes. You can also click another link to contact your local media and ask them to please do their job for once. And you can print out flyers to hand out at events, et cetera. And this website has existed for less than a week, since really late Thursday, and is just getting flooded with traffic. I can barely keep up with the organizations that want to join the coalition. So there's clear interest out there, and it's a matter of communicating it to Congress.
That's great. AfterDowningStreet.org. Feel free to toss the Tom Hartman program, if you consider this an organization, into your list, if that's of any value to you.
It'll be there in 10 minutes.
Okay. So, David Swanson, where do you think this is going to go? I mean, let's just realistically speaking, what's it going to take to make something out of this? And what are the what are the probabilities or possibilities of that happening?
It's an uphill fight, but anything's possible. One way that it's likely to go is that Congressman Conyers is putting together a team of investigators to go to London and to investigate these matters there. And as we know, there is mass media in England that does a much better job than ours on this side of the pond, and hopefully that will penetrate back into some of the media over here. In addition, this coalition of organizations all asking all of their members to send in letters and make phone calls to Congress is already having a huge effect. And
that's great. So step by step here. I've got a call. Dave in Humboldt County on the line. Let me just drop him in here. Dave, we've only got about 2 minutes left. What's up?
Well, gentlemen, you were just touching on my question, and that is that understanding that Europe still has something of a free press, how is Tony Blair holding up under this? He must have much of England all over his case.
Good question.
He does, indeed. There's an organization over there working with us called Military Families Against the War, mfaw.org/UK. And these are families of victims of British soldiers who died in this war. And they are all over Tony Blair on the Internet and in the media. And the Sunday Times in London is doing an admirable job of actually doing reporting.
The Sunday Times, owned by Rupert Murdoch.
What can I say? They're doing reporting. And they came out with these minutes on May 1st. They came out just yesterday with a new report on how in 2002 there was not just not just a conspiracy going on to cook up reasons for a war. They had actually started the war. The U.S. and British forces had actually dramatically increased bombings.
Right. We dropped more bombs in the second half of 2002 than in all of 2001.
Right.
In an attempt to provoke Saddam Hussein into attacking us in a way that we could call a provocation.
Exactly.
Which would be undermining the War Powers Clause of the Constitution, of course, which allows only Congress to declare war.
Right, because this was all before the resolution was passed by the House and Senate.
Correct,
before and it's even
effectively
asked
a de facto war starting.
Yeah, remarkable. Okay, we got to wrap it up. David Swanson with us, John Bonifaz. The group is AfterDowningStreet.org, www.AfterDowningStreet.org. D-O-W-N-I-N-G, Street, S-T-R-E-E-T, .org. Check it out. Gentlemen, thank you so much for being with us today.
Thank you,
Tom.
I appreciate it. Keep up the good work. It's a Tom Hartman radio program, 10 minutes before the hour.
You're listening to the Tom Hartman Program.
The moon is pulling at me. The moon is pulling at you. You swear to me it's the
And welcome back, my friends. 5 minutes before the hour, Tom Hartman here with you. And the winner is Iran. Michael Hill writes in the Baltimore Sun, Gulf actions of U.S. prove boon to Iran. Yes, friends, the country in the Middle East that viewed the Taliban as its enemies because they were Sunni fundamentalists were the Shia rulers of Iran. They really wanted the Taliban out of Afghanistan, which was on their border. They really were concerned about Osama bin Laden whipping up the Sunnis. And the other thing that they didn't like much was Saddam Hussein, because he was a secularist. He would not allow the religious to run his country. And he was also a Sunni Muslim. And so you had Sunnis in Afghanistan in control, into the Taliban, and you had the Sunnis in Iraq in control, in the secular, non-religious government of Saddam Hussein. And Iran wanted both countries to be run by Shia religious folks. They wanted the priests, the mullahs, to be running both countries. And guess who's running both countries now for all practical purposes? Yeah, you got it. No, Hamid Karzai is running. He's the mayor of Kabul. Right, let's be honest about this. He's the mayor of Kabul, a part of Kabul. He doesn't even control the entire city. The rest of Afghanistan has reverted back to the Taliban and back to the warlords. And the warlords are, by and large, you know, more on the side of Iran. So here we have, as Juan Cole, a professor specializing in Middle Eastern and South Asian history at the University of Michigan, says, everything has gone very well for the Iranians. They had two major geopolitical enemies in the region. One was the Taliban. The other was Saddam Hussein. From their point of view, the United States has very helpfully removed their major problems. It has not only helped remove these problems, but it has installed regimes that have strong traditional alliances with the Iranians. You'll recall, this is exactly the scenario that the Bush administration did not want to have happen, by the way. I mean, it's the exact scenario they didn't want. And now they've got it. So we'll see where they go with this. Time will tell, eh? Tom Hartman with you. Speaking truth to power. 5 days a week.
You've been listening to the Tom Hartman Program. Check our website at www.tomhartman.com for archives of this program and more information. We'll be right back. uncovers corporate lies, exposes political corruption, and has a clear vision of what America could become. Here's Tom Hartman.
And welcome back to the program, my friends. Patriots, lovers of democracy, truth, and justice, believers in peace, freedom, and the American way. Tom Hartman here with you, broadcasting live on Memorial Day, the 30th of May, Monday. Our telephone number, 1-866-889-8894. Toll free across the USA. And from outside the United States, 503-248-0620. And if you'd like to drop into our live chat room, go to tomhartman.com and click live chat, where we just had a little contest. Who is a true computer geek? I am. I am a longtime hardcore. I back when it was switches and lights, Altair, that was what it was. It was an Altair. The build them yourselves computers out of the back of popular, it was a Popular Electronics magazine. Must have been, what, 75, 78, something like that. And then, and anyhow, I said, Tristos forever. And people are like, Tristos, what's that? TRS-DOS. Tandy Radio Shack disk operating system. Radio Shack's, it was actually a pretty good operating system. It was an improvement over what had preceded it. Competing with CPM and competing with the early version of DOS and MS-DOS, Bill Gates had bought out a disk operating system that another guy had developed and turned it into a business, which is now known as Microsoft. Bill Gates, pretty good businessman. He's not quite the programmer he was given credit for, because he actually bought it from somebody else, but apparently a very, very competent businessman. Speaking of business, how can Tom DeLay get away with this? When, I mean, you look at the history of this thing with TRMPAC, the Texas Republicans for a Majority or whatever, Political Action Committee. Yeah, Texas Republicans for a Majority, Political Action Committee, TRMPAC, T-R-M-P-A-C. When you think back, Jim Wright was the Speaker of the House, the last, you know, major Democratic Speaker of the House, and he had to resign because he got money for a book. He made money on a book deal. Now, Newt got, what, like $1 million from Rupert Murdoch for his book? No problem. And then, of course, there was Bill Clinton. He, you know, he lied about having sex in the White House. They nailed him for that. So you got a guy who resigns because he has a book deal, and you got a guy who you know, is persecuted for, you know, basically shut down the government over this for a couple of years, because he was getting it on in the Oval Office and lied about it. And here we have Tom DeLay violating state election laws. Now, frankly, Bill Clinton's sex life is between, in my mind, is between him and his wife. And frankly, Jim Wright's book deal is between him and his bookkeeper. But a state election laws, I mean, if the beating heart of democracy is the vote, then the election laws are the things that protect democracy. So somebody who has violated the election laws has launched a full-scale frontal assault on democracy itself, not just their wife, not just their bookkeeper, not even something a little more, you know, broad and abstract like the tax laws or something like that. No. When you violate the election laws, you are taking on democracy itself. So here now, a judge in Texas has ruled that TRMPAC, this political action committee, has violated the state election laws. And what does Tom DeLay say about his association with TRMPAC? He says, and I quote, "I'm not part of it." End of quote. A reporter from CNN asked him if the ruling by the judge had any implications for Tom DeLay. Tom DeLay, "Not for me, I'm not part of it." Now, let's just get this right. This is from Daily Cause, by the way. Kos, K-U-S, K-O-S. Tom DeLay served as the creator of TrimPak. Maybe not the, one of the creators of TrimPak. He was an advisor to TrimPak. He has been one of its largest fundraisers. And if you don't believe it, ask Tom DeLay. On March 10th of this year, the Austin American Statesman ran an article about TrimPak, and they interviewed Tom DeLay, and Tom DeLay said to this newspaper that it was his idea to start the thing. Their own frequently asked questions, FAQ list, puts Tom DeLay as one of their leading members. Key leaders, actually, is the phrase. Tom DeLay's name is on their stationery. It's on their promotional materials. He did fundraising for them. And now he is saying to a reporter from CNN, who did not challenge him on it, as, you know, in order to be a reporter for CNN these days, you have to be a wimp. CNN, the bunch whose vice president made a pilgrimage to Washington, D.C. in December of 2000 to apologize to recently selected, or it was January 2001, to apologize to recently selected, now, you know, soon-to-be President George W. Bush Jr. for the coverage of him leading up to the election and assure him that coverage would be more favorable in the future. CNN asked him, yeah, what about your association with TrimPak? I'm no part of it. Got nothing to do with me. Yeah. At the same time that DeLay is trying to weasel out of any association with criminal activity at TrimPak, we can bring this back around to Memorial Day today, May 30th, Monday, May 30th. As many as 2.4 million low-income people will miss out on generous savings when the Medicare prescription bill benefit, or prescription drug benefit, excuse me, begins next year because they have too many personal assets, reports Tony Pugh for Knight Ridder Newspapers. Now, get this. You know, starting January 1st, starting the beginning of the year, 7 months from now, 6 months from now, almost exactly 6 months from now, 6 months and 2 days from now, people who are on Medicaid will be able to have their sum of, you know, the first couple $1,000s, and then there's the famous donut hole. But nonetheless, they'll be able to have some of their prescription drugs paid for by Medicare. And when this bill was being pushed through Congress, in order to keep the cost of it below $400 billion, now we've since learned that Tom Scully was lying to us all along, and in fact had been lying to Congress, because the internal estimates that DeLay and Hastert and these guys, the real numbers were that the cost was going to be over $550 billion. Some estimates go as high as $1.2 trillion, depending on how badly the drug companies can screw us all, because the Medicare bill that the Republicans passed, and only Republicans could do this, the Medicare bill that the Republicans passed said that our tax dollars have to go to buy drugs from the big pharmaceutical companies at full retail only. We are not allowed to buy drugs for the Medicare program from the big pharmaceutical companies at wholesale. We, the people, with our tax dollars being used for Medicare, are not allowed by law, by the Medicare bill that the Republicans passed through the House, Republican House, the Republican Senate, that we are not allowed by law to buy pharmaceuticals at wholesale from the big drug companies. No, we have to pay full retail. It's called giving your friends a free ride. So in order to hold down the costs on this thing, they said, okay, well, let's only make this available to people who have And now this is where it's really going to surprise a lot of people who are eligible for Medicare. We're only going to make it available to people who have assets worth less than $11,500 if you're single, or $23,000 if you're married. In other words, elderly people who have done what they were told to do, right, save some money for your retirement, and have managed to save more than $11,500, will be told in January when they apply for the Medicare drug benefit, sorry, you're too rich. Medicare should not be means-tested like this. It's not a welfare program. This is the Republicans trying to convert Social Security and Medicare from entitlement programs for everybody, part of a social safety net for everybody, part of a retirement for everybody that everybody can plan on throughout their lives. You just factor it into the equation. They convert them from those kinds of programs into welfare programs that are only available to the most poor and that are very easy to vote against, because the most poor tend not to be so politically active. The most poor tend not to be covered in television news coverage. The most poor tend to be more invisible in America. So doing away with welfare as we know it, like Bill Clinton proudly proclaimed he was going to do, actually is fairly popular, because the most poor we don't see until they stick a gun in our faces, but that's a whole another discussion, I suppose. With the most poor elderly, they're not going to be sticking a gun in anybody's face. They'll just die. So if you have $11,501 in the bank in your savings, just in case, for example, the roof of your house starts leaking, and you're elderly and you're poor, you are too rich to get the Medicaid drug benefit, the wealthy Republicans have decided. Sorry, tough luck. Come back again in another incarnation. Oh, excuse me, the Republicans are not into that either. This is just wrong. I'll tell you, this is just wrong. They interviewed this guy, Thomas Walker. He's living on Social Security. He's got $35,000 in the bank in stock. And he says he's hanging on to this for if his car breaks down, if his roof starts leaking, right, like that. He says, if I have to pay Medicare in a matter of time, I'm going to be broke. He says, my truck is 20 years old. I'm going to have to replace it at some point. What am I supposed to do when my roof fails? He says, I just don't think it's fair and there's nobody to lash out at. Oh, yeah? Well, yeah, they reported this in Knight Ridder newspapers. There's nobody to lash out at. How about the Republican Party? 20 minutes past the hour.
This is the Tom Hartman Program.
They never stop thinking about new ways to harm our country and our people, and neither do we.
This is an impressive crowd, the haves and the have-mores. Some people call you the elite. I call you my base.
You gave them the old razzle-dazzle. You razzle-dazzle.
Oh, you did such a good job, George Jr. You
gave them an act with lots of flash in it. Made them believe you were compassionate.
Oh, it was brilliant.
You gave them the old hocus-pocus. Yeah, misdirected him.
Yes, it's just like
with
David Cooper
and Saddam Hussein. You played them both right to perfection, despite the fact there's no connection. You razzle-dazzled them, let those blue states complain.
If this were a dictatorship, it'd be a heck of a lot easier. Just so long as I'm the dictator.
Yes, just as long as I'm the dictator, yes, it'd be a whole lot easier, yes. Welcome back, my friend.
Yeah, yes. The old, the real voice, the welcome, well, welcome back. Tom Hartman here with you, 1-866-889-8894. Our telephone number, TomHartman.com, the website if you'd like to drop in and say hello. We were just ranting about Medicare. I thought it was interesting talking with Scott during the break, Scott and Louise, about the Teamsters strike. The Teamsters now are out on strike against Coca-Cola in Los Angeles. And why is it that when I Google this thing, I only find one little story in the L.A. Times? And it's like, why isn't this major national news? The Teamsters are calling for a nationwide boycott of Coke products. If you're in solidarity with organized labor, and in general, and Teamsters in specific, then they say don't use Coke products. Don't buy Coke products. And, you know, why isn't, Scott, for example, was saying, well, you know, Pepsi will get a hold of that, and they'll turn it into something. I don't think so. I think that the corporations, when it comes to fighting organized labor, the corporations stand together. Pepsi's never going to think of the Teamsters as their friends. I just, you know, at least in my opinion. Maybe I'm wrong. You know, call me up and let me know if you think I'm wrong on this, but I don't think so. Speaking of the corporate power and the, you know, I still find it amazing. Can you imagine in the state of Washington, you've got Dino Rossi, the Republican who lost by 129 votes or something like that to Christine Gregoire. They're still fighting. I mean, he's suing her to say, you know, to try and have basically a new election. Can you imagine if the vote, if in the Washington state, the votes had been done on voting machines, and if the president of the voting machine company had said that he was going to be sure that Christine Gregoire got in as governor? The Republicans would be, they would be all over that. But nationally? No. And here now, this question. The Census Bureau just announced that 125.7 million people voted. This according to the United States Census Bureau. But the official tabulation was 122.3 million voters. That produces a discrepancy of 3.4 million missing votes, which is about the 3% that Kerry was leading Bush in the exit polls that just kind of vanished overnight on election eve. Remember, I was doing election coverage at WDEV in Waterbury, Vermont, election night. And sure enough, 10:30, 11 o'clock, the AP came on and they said, Karen Hughes just sat George Bush down to tell him that he's lost the election based on the exit polls. He didn't seem concerned. And an hour and a half later, the same AP was calling the election for Bush. But an hour and a half before, they'd been saying, well, Bush has clearly lost. We've got the polls. So where did those 3.4 million votes go? Good question. Inquiring minds want to know. Get into that right after this. This is the Tom Hartman radio program, 29 minutes past the hour on this Memorial Day afternoon.
This is the Democracy Zone with Tom Hartman.
I lived with them on Montague Street in a basement down the stairs. There was music in the cafes at night and revolution in the air.
Well,
he started into dealing with slaves and something inside of him died. She had to sell everything she owned and froze up inside. And when it all came crashing down, I became withdrawn. The only thing I knew how to do was keep on keeping on like a bird that flew.
Ah, yes. Welcome back, my friends. Tom Hartman here with you, 27 minutes before the hour. Where did 3.4 million votes go? Is revolution in the air? Somehow I doubt it. Although I think perhaps regime change is in the air. We do have an election coming up another year from now. And now is the time to start getting active in not only working for the candidates of your choice, but in also working for the voting machines of your choice. The news reporting that Miami-Dade County, Florida, has strongly recommended, or at least their elections chief has strongly recommended, that the ATM-style voting machines, the voting machines where, you know, it's a touchscreen machine, and when it says Jeb Bush and Jeb Bush's opponent, and you push Jeb Bush's opponent's name, it says thank you for voting for Jeb Bush. And it has in the last two elections. Thousands of reports of this happening. And strangely, the same thing happened with George Bush. Well, in Miami-Dade, they're saying, maybe it's time to get rid of these machines. Let's go back to paper. Let's go back to paper. Well, you know, here's where it gets interesting and a little bit problematic. See, everybody loves paper. They say, isn't it great? You fill out the ballots and you ink and fill in the little holes or the circles or you whatever. And you have a paper trail, and you can go back and you can look at that paper trail and you can audit. But the reality is, as we discovered in Ohio, in those precincts and in those counties where there was a paper trail, that the paper trail never gets counted if the Republican machine doesn't want it to be counted. But it was counted once. It was counted on election night, and it was counted by machine, and by a machine, in many cases, manufactured by Diebold or ES&S. Even here in the state of Oregon, we vote by mail, and the vote by mail ballots are counted by machines that in part come from Diebold and ES&S. So the folks in Miami-Dade County, they're saying, let's go back to the paper, but who's going to count the paper? Well, of course, it's going to be these big companies. And here's where it gets particularly curious. Tallahassee, Florida. This on the blackboxvoting.org website. A post from the board administrator, I'm assuming that's Bev Harris. Tallahassee, Florida, quote, are we having fun yet, end quote. She notes, this is the message that appeared in the window of a county optical scan machine, startling Leon County Information Systems Officer Thomas James. Visibly shaken, he immediately turned the machine off. Can you imagine that? You're the election officer for Leon County, Florida, and you look at your optical scan machine, the machine you're about to feed all these ballots into, and the screen says, are we having fun yet? They had just hacked the machine. Diebold's OptiScan paper ballot voting system uses a curious memory card design, offering penetration by a lone programmer such that standard canvassing procedures cannot detect election manipulation. The Diebold optical scan system was used in about 800 jurisdictions in 2004. Among them were several hotbeds of controversy: Volusia County, Florida, King County, Washington, and the New Hampshire primary election, where machine results differed markedly from hand-counted localities. So the paper ballot optical scan machines are more easily hacked, or just as easily hacked. And the voters think that there's a paper trail, even though it only gets read in a rare circumstance. And in Ohio, you've got two different candidates who raised $250,000 to try and get it read. And the voting machine companies came in and said to the elections officials, and this has been documented, it was documented by John Conyers in his report, the Conyers Commission report, his House Judiciary Committee, went down to Ohio, took a week of testimony, and you can read it. It's now available in paperback, a book called What Went Wrong in Ohio, published by Chicago Academy Press with foreword by Gore Vidal. And sure enough, Triad Voting Systems, one of the computer companies, went in and said to the people in one of the counties there, I forget which county it was, might have been Miami County, and in any case, it was in Ohio, and they said, here's the numbers that you're supposed to write down and say this is the numbers that you had, because this is the number that will agree with the machine. Forget about whatever you count by hand. Write down that this is the number that you counted. Yep, they did. Conyers documents it. Nobody cares. And had the number been different, then they would have had to recount all the ballots. But the number wasn't different, so they didn't have to recount all the ballots. So Ken Blackwell gets off, and George Bush stays president. Go figure. So we have corporations running our voting machines, corporations running our media, corporations saying, eh, you don't need to know about the Teamsters strike. Eh, you don't need to know about the paper ballots. Yeah, you don't need to know about, you know, the high crimes and misdemeanors. You don't need to know about the Downing Street memo. Nah. You need to know about Michael Jackson. You need to know about the runaway bride. That's the important stuff. That's going to change your life. 1-866-889-8894, our telephone number. Michelle in Cypress, California on the line. Hey, Michelle.
Hey, Tom. I think this is the second time I've called in.
Well, welcome back.
Yes, I love your show.
Thank you.
I don't always get to listen to it, but today, luckily, we're not marching to some other beat. I was calling in reference to what you were talking about with the Teamsters strike, and, you know, kind of that you just, there was just a little blurb in the L.A. Times.
Yeah, did your local newspaper report on this?
No.
Mine did not. Here in the largest newspaper in the state of Oregon, the Oregonian, owned by Newhouse Publishers or whatever they're called. Not one word, or maybe it's there and I just didn't see it. It's possible.
Well, yeah,
but,
exactly.
You know, it's
Orange County Register.
Oh, my. You have my sympathies.
Yes, exactly. Orange Curtain area.
Yes.
And it goes along with last Wednesday, there was a big rally in Sacramento and in Pershing Square in downtown L.A., and you know, you hardly saw anything about that, and that was protesting Arnold Schwarzenegger. There were 10,000 people, including me, in Pershing Square.
And it didn't get reported?
No. I mean, they had a little blurb on TV, but you would think that you would see more about this when it's 10,000 in L.A. and 20,000 in Sacramento.
Yeah.
And maybe I didn't see it either. I mean, you know, when you're busy being an activist and trying to get out, sometimes, you know, you
well,
just...
you know, I would say that the media played a huge role in getting Arnold elected in California.
Oh, exactly.
You know, because we have now infotainment instead of news, and the tainment part of it is all about stars and star power, and he's a star. So,
well,
you know,
and
bingo.
I wanted to tell you, you were just talking about voting. And I'm trying to get this through to people, and a great place to understand about the paper trails really isn't going to solve it is Open Voting Consortium.
Mm-hmm.
And they're proposing a totally different voting system, and they're trying to educate people on the whole paper trail with these machines is not going to help. It's that they have, those companies have control over that whole program.
Right.
It just, you know, as Bev Harris has well educated us all on that one, just a little bit too late that we noticed.
So what's the alternative system that they're recommending?
Well, they're suggesting that, you know, for one thing, that no company has ownership over it,
make our voting something that we the people own? How outrageous.
I know. It's just an amazing thing. And
I mean, you know, that would be like, you know, we control our police departments and our fire departments, but should we control our voting? Come on, Michelle.
I know. I'm in la-la land, aren't I?
That's just not Republican enough. I'm sorry.
Well, Tom, as usual, you've made me laugh.
Good. Michelle, yeah, thanks for the call and thanks for the information.
We'll be thinking of our military that has fallen and
yes.
And those families today. I that's what I'm trying to keep in my heart is the families and their suffering.
Oh, and there's so much of it now in America.
Yeah.
I mean, there are so many families. There have to be if we have, you know, 1,600 and change coming on 1,700 dead. And the official numbers, you know, 15,000 to 20,000 wounded, and
right.
When you consider psychological wounds, probably at least 100,000 wounded. there are a lot of families, a lot of people in America who are touched by this.
Yeah, I don't think everybody's going to find out about it until maybe a year before Bush gets out of office, the true realities.
Oh, yeah. I don't think anybody's going to find out the true reality until after Bush is out of office. But
yeah, that's probably
that's
true.
Just my cynical. Anyhow,
all right,
Michelle,
you take care of your family.
You too. You
okay.
too. Thanks, Michelle.
Tom.
I appreciate the call. Good to hear from you. It, by the way, just back to the voting thing. On June 9th and 10th, if you happen to be in Washington, D.C., or if you have plans on going to Washington, D.C. for that period of time, or if you'd like a rationale or a reason, a good excuse to go to Washington, D.C., there's a coalition of citizens and grassroots organizations that will be joining forces in Washington, D.C. on June 9th and 10th to lobby for the passage of H.R. 550, House Resolution 550, which is Rush Holt's bill, which Bernie Sanders has co-sponsored, that verifiedvoting.org is in favor of, Vote Trust USA, Rock the Vote, Common Cause, and others. They say this bill is it. Rush Holt, of course, a physicist, a guy with a PhD in physics. So, you know, he would have some sense, one would think, about technology and computers and what might work and all that kind of thing. If you want to go to Washington, D.C. and go knock on the doors of your member of Congress and other members of Congress pushing for this, June 9th and 10th, and you can find out more about it by going to verifiedvoting.org. Check that out. Tim in Peoria, Illinois, with us on Memorial Day. Hey, Tim.
Hi, Tom. Thanks for being there on Memorial Day for the reality-based community.
You're welcome. Yes.
The other day I saw Enron, the smartest guys in the room, by director Alex Gibney.
Yes, we saw that 2 weeks ago when I came here to Portland. In fact, I interviewed Alex on my local show.
Oh, I missed that. Great peek into the Enron corporate culture of lies.
Not only that, what amazed me about that movie was that finally somebody was talking in a major, I suppose it's as major as these kinds of things can get anyway, major movie, about Arnold Schwarzenegger's involvement with Enron and the energy crisis in California that just sort of happened to catapult him into governorship. And why has that not been raised in California? Why are people discussing that?
Wonder why.
Well, you're in Illinois and I'm in Oregon, so I guess neither one of us are qualified to say. Maybe one of our California listeners will let us know. How come nobody is talking about impeaching or whatever you do with the referendum, withdrawing or replacing or unseating or whatever, Arnold Schwarzenegger for his involvement in the Enron scandals?
Well, it might come up after all. He's sliding down pretty fast. A second thing I wanted to mention is something that lifted my eyebrows. Today, the mainstream Minneapolis Sun Tribune, in an editorial, says George Bush lied about the reason to attack Iraq.
Oh, really?
And the editorial goes on to talk about the Downing Street memo. How about that for a mainstream newspaper?
Hey, not too shabby.
The eyebrows are still up.
Yeah.
Thanks, Tom.
Yeah, thanks a lot, Tim. Good to hear from you. Okay. Interesting. 1-866-889-8894, telephone number. Chris in Baltimore on the line. Hey, Chris, what's up?
Not too much, Tom. Just happy to have Memorial Day off and get a chance to listen to your show live.
Yeah, well, thank you. I thank you for calling.
Listen, I enjoy your show a lot, there's a but.
Okay.
But is this. I have a big stake in this whole electronic voting debate because I am totally blind.
Uh-huh.
And, you know, you guys in the, the anti-electronic voting crowd, you weren't satisfied with the electronic voting machines, which to some extent I can understand, but now you're worried about optical scan, and of course EF&S makes the AutoMark machine, which makes optical scan-based voting accessible to disabled people.
Right.
And I'm like, what do you guys want?
I'll tell you very simply, Chris. And first of all, I'm not opposed to electronic voting. I'm opposed to corporate ownership of electronic voting. And I've been saying that right from the beginning. And that was the whole point of my conversation with Michelle just a few minutes ago. If we're going to have our vote being counted by machines, those machines should be owned by us, should be programmed by us, and the people programming them should be civil servants who are accountable to us. That's my beef.
Okay. I know you guys, you say all the time, you certainly don't have any problem with accessibility to the disabled. But
I'm all in favor of it. totally.
But, But yet, you know, we can't seem to find a solution that folks are happy with.
So I think there's a very simple solution, Chris, and it's public ownership of it. It's, you know, as I said to Michelle, have it just like the police department and the fire department. We own it. Rather than have it be owned by a private corporation whose first imperative is money. And what I'm seeing is Diebold and ESNS playing the disabled community in America like a fiddle, you know, like a violin, just, you know, pulling on their heartstrings, saying, hey, these folks, they're going to leave you guys out in the cold and they're not interested in disabled. No, that's not it at all. They're trying to change the subject. The debate here should not be electronic voting machines or not, or paper trail or not, or this or that. It should be who controls the vote. Is it controlled by a for-profit corporation, or is it controlled by we the people? And then once we figure out who's going to control the vote, then we make sure it's accessible to everybody. Make
sense?
Sounds
good.
Okay. Thanks a lot, Chris. I appreciate it. Good hearing from you. 10 minutes before the hour.
This is the Democracy Zone with Tom Hartman.
Oh, yeah, back to democracy, please. Yeah, let's get these cons out of office. We've had enough wars, enough destruction of the middle class, enough destruction of the environment, enough trees. We'd like fresh water again, please. How about some air we can breathe? How about decent gas mileage? Take us back there, hey? Oh, yeah. Maybe she will. Maybe she will. Just to wrap this thing up on voting machines, I just want to say, if we are going to go to instant runoff voting, which I believe is really important for democracy in the United States. They've done it in New Zealand. They've done it in Australia. If we're going to go to instant runoff voting, then probably the most efficient system is going to end up being computerized in some way. Computerized clearly with a paper trail. Obviously, we want to have a paper trail so that things can be verified before and after the fact, and that any voting machine that produces a paper trail, that paper trail actually should be the ballot, not a receipt of the ballot, it should be the ballot. But that said, it's, you know, you could argue computers shouldn't be any part of it, and in fact, in a lot of European countries, when I lived in Germany, you know, they still take 4 days off where, you know, it's 4 days more or less before you know the actual result of the election. And civil servants sit down by hand and count the ballots. Because it's all done, you know, the old-fashioned way. But still, and by the way, you know the outcome of the election within a half hour of the time the polls close because of the exit polls. And the exit polls in the history of modern German democracy have never been more than 0.1% off. The same exit polls that showed that Al Gore won Florida. And now we know, in fact, that he did. And that John Kerry won not just Ohio, but the United States. And I'm strongly of the opinion that he did. The same exit polls who showed that the election in the Ukraine was rigged. In Serbia was rigged. Excuse me, in Bosnia was rigged. And in Soviet Georgia was rigged. So anyhow, but ultimately when it gets back down to it, I think that the issue is going to be who owns the computers, who's programming them. I think if the software was completely open source, you know, like they're doing with Linux or Linux or however you say it, that we the people wouldn't allow it to be hackable. I really think it's possible to say, you know, we're going to create a system together. We'll put our heads together. We'll create a system that can't be hacked and that is accountable to us. And I believe that that's what Rush Holt's bill is working for. So let your member of Congress, your Congress member, know that that's something you'd like to see happen. You can call them 1-877-SOB-USOB for the White House or the Capitol switchboard. Let them know. See you tomorrow.
You've been listening to the Tom Hartman Program. Check our website at www.tomhartman.com for archives of this program and more information.